Good morning, brethren. This is Resurrection morning. You know, the interesting thing about this year's calendar, the Julian calendar of April corresponds day by day with Nisan this year. So Nisan 1 was April 1, and April 13th, the evening that began our memorial on the 14th, was also the same. And another peculiarity is that the days of the week also correspond with the days of the week, so that Thursday was Memorial Day and Friday was the day of Jesus' crucifixion, and Sunday corresponding to this day, the day of his resurrection. So we have much to rejoice in these precious memories of this season of the year. A little footnote on last night's review of Foreign Lands. I have an extra videotape of a summary of our travels in Romania, and if anyone would care for that tape, you're welcome to it. And so someone can approach me afterwards if they would like to have a videotape, or if anyone else I can send an extra copy to. The days of Noah. Of all the patriarchs, there is none so noble and yet obscure as Noah. He was the 10th in the genealogy from Adam, yet he could not have met Adam. Adam died 126 years before his birth, and Adam's son Seth died just 14 years before Noah's birth. Think of that. Noah's father, Lamech, could have easily conversed with both Adam and, of course, his son Noah. He had an important heritage to pass on to his son. Noah, who now lay beyond all direct acquaintance with Eden, and yet had from his father the information that his father had in talking with Adam. Other than his work concerning the deluge, however, we know very little of other events of Noah's life. We know his first child was born when he was 500 years old. This was probably Japheth. But we do not know the name of his wife, nor the names of his sons' wives. We can deduce that his father Lamech died just 5 years before the flood, and that Methuselah died in the very year of the flood. Our curious minds might ask if the flood was arranged to occur only after all the righteous ancestors of Noah had died. Or were there preparations to take them on the ark also, had they lived just a bit longer? These are questions that we don't have direct answers for now. But outside of the flood, what else do we know about Noah? Well, given the human situation, there are a number of things that we can infer. Genesis 6, verse 8 and 9. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God. In these simple phrases, there is a profound character revealed. Noah was not this simplistic man sometimes pictured characteristically in cartoons. Noah was a patriarch. He undoubtedly had the wisdom of the generations before him, as Enoch and Methuselah, informed in astronomy. in engineering, in the sciences, in mathematics. This was certainly necessary for the construction of the ark. The earlier verses reveal a situation where angels materialized to cohabit with beautiful women of the earth. Their offspring were a distortion of the genetic structure in such a way that all the children appear to have been male. Very interesting phenomena. Genesis 6, verse 4. And they were called Nephilim. These giants imposed their reign of tyranny on mankind until there were nearly none left who were not subject to their dominion. That their fathers were angels is derived from the phrase, sons of God. This is an idiomatic expression, and where it is used in Job, Psalms, and Daniel, it always refers to spirit beings. This invasion into the human procreation was a distortion of the human program and was promoted by Satan to thwart the work of the promised seed of the woman and to impose his own dominion. This was the second of several attempts to destroy the seed of the woman. The first was when Cain was incited to kill his brother. The seed of Abraham was disputed by Hagar and Ishmael. Pharaoh sought to kill all the firstborn males and nearly entrapped Moses, and later tried to prevent the Israelites from departing to the promised land. Herod sought to the child's life and destroy the seed. Jesus in the wilderness was tempted to take his own life. Perhaps Satan thought for a moment he had succeeded at the cross. But the natural seed continued, and then a spiritual seed appeared. Saints were killed, but not destroyed. The Holocaust took many of the natural seed, but the promise is sure. This early apostasy by Satan and the fallen angels created a bleak prospect for Noah in planning for another generation. He had no polluted breeding in his own ancestry. We do not know when he took a wife, but we can be sure he carefully investigated her genealogy before binding his life with hers. She may have also been from the lineage of Enoch or Methuselah. In fact, he may have only married after several hundred years. They did not have children until he was 500. They may not have been married long before that, and she may have been considerably younger than he. Their sons, though taking wives of pure lineage also, delayed having children till after the flood, when they were above 100 years old. So these years before the flood were occupied with keeping themselves separate from the world. Yet they were a spectacle to men and angels while building the ark. Their labors and clarity of vision were not appreciated by an evil generation. Theirs was a mission to deliver the race into a new world. There is a text that has some obscure meaning in Genesis 6, verse 3. The Lord said, "My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he is also flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years." Among Bible students, there has been much speculation about this text and its various readings. Brother Russell has very little to say upon it. The word strive has variously been rendered to rule, to abide, to struggle, to tarry, and so forth. That he is also flesh has been rendered become flesh, is mortal, become carnal, and so forth. And so various questions are raised about what does this text mean? When were the words decreed? At the first outbreak of apostasy? 120 years before the flood? When iniquity had reached a point of no return? We don't know exactly when they were spoken. Who first heard these words? Noah? Or his righteous ancestors? Upon whom is the 120 years really decreed? Was it Adam? The Nephilim? Noah? Or the generations after the flood? Was this some kind of limit or extremity of human life that now could live no longer than that? What was the decree exactly, and what was its purpose? The years left to Adam at the time of speaking? The years left to the Nephilim before the flood? The years of Noah at the time of hearing before the flood? The years of Noah, or rather the diminished lifespan of mankind in generations after the flood? These are some of the possibilities about what this text means. Well, among all these theories, we are persuaded of a very simple application. We think that the words were probably decreed 120 years before the flood. That Noah was the primary audience and intended for the hearing. That they referred to the probation period on the Nephilim before the flood took them all away. Perhaps the meaning is simply this. These spirits will not always struggle with mankind. Since they have chosen to become flesh, they will be cut off after 120 years. This thought appeals to my own mind. This rises out of the meaning of 1 Peter 3, verse 20. Here he speaks of the disobedience of the angels while God waited during the preparation of the ark. We think the waiting is the same as 120 years. The ark may have been in preparation for all or only some portion of this 120 years. However, Noah's children were born only 100 years before the flood. It is possible Noah heard this warning 120 years before the flood and began his own family planning in preparation for the event. By the year of the flood, his sons were married but had no children. Except for the small family of 8 souls, all others of their ancestors had died. Apparently, all others were contaminated with the evil seed. We can only imagine Noah's courage of faith in preaching the judgments declared in these years, his persistence in the face of scoffers, and his deep commitment to the creatures to be transported into the new dispensation, the new world. Hebrews 11, verse 7. By faith, Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. The dimensions of the ark are given as 300 by 50 by 30 cubits. We think this was ample room to store all the species native to the area, today known as Iran and Iraq and Turkey. The only features mentioned are that it had three stories, a door, and a window. It had neither masts, rudder, nor sails. This was not a ship that could be navigated by its passengers. It was a floating barge for containing animals and food for a year. God controlled its destiny, not man. Someday mankind may have a better look at this craft of deliverance when the snows yield its secret treasures. The creatures were to be gathered by sevens for clean animals and by twos for unclean. The reason for sevens may have been because of their use for food as well as for sacrifice, while the unclean only had to fill their role in the ecological balance. The sevens, perhaps, were composed of three pairs, male and female, plus an extra male for sacrifice. The animals probably came uncoerced to Noah's shelter, because often the beasts of the earth are wiser than man when faced with earth's dilemmas. They know where there is food and shelter from the storm when man does not. In Genesis 6, verse 18, God promises to make a covenant with his small family about to face the storm. Later in Genesis 9, verse 12, he does make a covenant with them and with all the creatures that come forth with him. So, with this hope in hand, all the remnant proceed toward the shelter against the tempest. Now a curiously detailed sequence of events is recorded, beginning in Genesis 7. First, there seems to be 7 days of waiting when all the work was complete, yet before the family entered. This is recorded in the 4th, 10th, and 13th verses. Then, after entering, the Lord shut the door. In verse 16. On the second month and the 17th day of the month, the flood waters broke forth and the downpour continued for 40 days. The record is found in the 11th, 12th, and 17th verses. Even after the rain ceased, the free-floating of the ark and the tidal waters continued another 110 days, or for a total now of 150 days since entering the ark. Genesis 7:24 and 8:3. On the seventh month, the 17th day, or just 5 months after the outbreak, the ark came to rest on some ridge of Ararat, and the waters continued to recede. On the 10th month and the first day, the family could see other mountains due to the clearing of the atmosphere and the receding waters. chapter 8, verse 5. After another 40 days, Noah opened a window and sent forth a raven. It appears not to have returned, but as a carrion creature went to and fro on the waters, feeding on the corpses. Then after a week, he sent forth a dove. Not being a meat eater, the dove returned to the ark, finding no place for rest. Another week passed, and he sent the dove again. It returned with an olive leaf plucked from a sprouting tree. Yet another week passed, and he sent forth the dove again. It did not return, apparently finding some dry place to build a nest for a new generation. Chapter 8, 7 through 12, are the record of these birds being sent forth. In the second year now, and the first day of the year, the face of the ground was dry. Chapter 8, verse 13. The second year, second month, 27th day, or just exactly 1 year and 10 days after entering the ark, the ground was sufficiently dry to emerge. Noah, his family, and all breathing creatures went forth and multiplied on the face of the earth. The first act of Noah is to build an altar. And from among the clean animals, he offered a burnt offering. A tradition prevails that he fueled the altar with wood from the door of the ark. His gesture was one of faith that it would not be needed ever again. Noah had already sacrificed his home, his society, his whole world. Now he made this offering in gratitude for deliverance. Would God be pleased with his conduct? The animals were the seed and food for a new society. This is the very first mention of an altar and burnt offerings on an altar. Would God accept this tribute representing the very essence of their livelihood? God received it as the sweetest of human gestures and vowed not to curse the ground or smite every living creature again. Chapter 8, 20 and 21. From this time there appears to emerge a distinction of seasons for sowing and harvest upon the earth. Verse 22. In all the events of this tumultuous year, we see nothing of the death struggle. We do not witness the frantic agony going on outside of the ark. Nothing of the anxiety of man or beast inside for food or light. Nor is there a single word of regret or lament for the world that was left behind. There was nothing to salvage from the old order except the seed of hope that was sown in Eden. Genesis 9 records the Noah covenant. Having come through the waters, God established an everlasting covenant with man and beast. There will never again be a flood to destroy all flesh. The rainbow is the token of this covenant. Whenever God brings a cloud over the earth, he will remember his covenant with every living creature. Now let us look briefly at the New Testament references to these events. We'll just give you the references. We will not read them now. Matthew 24:37-39. The parallel account is in Luke 17, beginning in verse 26. We did read Hebrews 11:7. And then in Peter, there's three references. 1 Peter 3:19-20. 2 Peter 2:4-5. And 2 Peter 3:4-7. And this 2 Peter 3:4-7 is basically a reference back to Isaiah 54:9-10. The Matthew and Luke accounts are properly read with emphasis on the sign of ignorance of the impending events. Though the antediluvians were awfully wicked, it is not primarily their wickedness, but their worldliness, their unbelief, and indifference to the future that we are called upon to notice. Luke 17:27 makes the same point and adds that this disregard for the impending events continued until the day Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. It was this willing disregard, this lack of heeding the message of Noah, that we are called upon to notice. Noah, a preacher of righteousness, 2 Peter 2:5. The parallelism with our day is obvious. Noah's family is a picture of the church in the flesh before their deliverance. Notice a similar message of Elijah in Malachi 4:5-6, to turn the hearts of the fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. The day of the Lord has now been observed and proclaimed for 121 years. It has been 117 years since the spiritual heavens were cast off. Today the world is in a more sorry state than it was then. The financial systems of the world are bankrupt. While the nations of Europe plan for a grandiose financial unity with hopes to heal the fractured nations of the world, it is a vain hope. High society eats sumptuously while Somalia starves. America practices a political charade while blood runs in the streets of Yugoslavia. Babylon says, I am rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing. I sit as a queen and am no widow and shall see no sorrow. Yet she is poor, blind, and naked. This is certainly ignorance of the impending desolation of the present social order. Yet this only whets our appetite to look further for correspondences. Matthew 24:30-35 mentions other key elements of the days of Noah. Clouds of heaven, all the tribes of the earth mourn, the gathering of the elect, this generation, heaven and earth pass away. Such phrases are drawn directly from the days of Noah. I think the phrase eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage have special meaning. They are identical in Matthew and Luke. They are acts of self-preservation and pleasure. To eat is to preserve self first. It does not say to serve or feed others, but to consume upon oneself. Drinking may imply a state of intoxication, illusion, and self-delusion. In ancient times, marriage was a form of royal alliance, and in some cases, compromise. Families might give a daughter, even to a foreign tribe, in return for assurances of non-aggression. So it is today. There is no global view of human need. Nations, states, cities, corporations, and people consume and feed their own interests first, to feed their securities with little regard of how others may suffer. The nations are drunk with their own illusions of glory and ambition of a new world order by their own hands. How presumptuous. Alliances are formed with hope for aid in time of trouble that are not worth the paper they are written upon, which evaporate when nations cannot even help themselves. Daughter institutions are given over to world evangelism and ecumenical unions to promote a vision of world unity. But it is an illusion. While acknowledging the point of ignorance that Jesus makes, it cannot be forgotten that the days of Noah were indeed wicked and were dominated by fallen angels and their giant offspring. Jude verse 6 seems to describe the state of fallen angels of Noah's day. They were bound in darkness until the judgment of the great day. This implies a test in the last days in which we are living, in which even yet they might again assert their apostasy. In Noah's day, their children were giants of oppression and violence. These were destroyed and were not delivered nor survived the flood. In our day, the giants are global mega institutions of finance, government, corporate and military might. They are cruel, inhuman, and oppressive in nature. They are spawned by evil spirits and ambitions of worldly ambition. Jude extends his analogy in the picture of Sodom and Gomorrah in verse 7. He says the cities were given over to fornication, going after strange flesh. This strange flesh was the angelic materialization assumed in the night of Lot's deliverance in Genesis 19. In our day, the unions with these angelic forms of New Age ideology and philosophy are condemned by Earth's new administrator. It is interesting in Luke 17, in that account, Jesus follows the example of Noah with that of Lot. The two stories seem to be related in his message. Lot and Sodom, found in verses 28 and 29. Luke 17, 28, 29. So after the deliverance of the church, may see society abandoned to the depths of such depravity. While Noah and his family are generally taken to correspond to the faithful and righteous church, in the last days, Lot is taken as a picture of the great company who find accommodation in worldly surroundings. So this picture of being pulled from the fire follows the example of delivering Noah. The great company are pictured in Jeremiah 8 as a class who entered into defense cities and later acknowledged the harvest is past, the summer is ended, and they are not saved. 2 Peter 2, 4 through 7 also expands on this same sequence. Noah and Lot. But brethren, let our lives be like Noah. Let it be like Abraham, who not only delivered themselves, but became instruments of the deliverance of others. The Sodom picture is the final stage of trouble, following the Noah picture when the church has the door closed behind them. The Luke account of Jesus' words, Luke 17:29, uses the word apocalypsis, not parousia, for the revealing of the Son of Man in this final trauma. Then, of course, there is the picture of Lot's wife. In Luke 17:32, Jesus concludes the metaphor by telling us to remember Lot's wife. She being turned to salt is a picture of second death, final destruction. Let us not cling to earthly institutions and their elusive promises. Let it be that our faithfulness be established before the Sodom picture comes upon this generation. The days of Noah were days of preaching. Hebrews 11, verse 7 says Noah was warned. 2 Peter 2, verse 5 says he preached. 2 Peter 3 says his message was scorned. Do we expect that our message will be broadly received? Or, if it is not broadly received, will we be silent in declaring the overthrow of this old order and the new dispensation blessings that lie just beyond the flood of trouble? No, this is our message and our mission. But Noah was not only preaching. He was working and building. In some sense, the ark represents Christ's covenant, a sacrifice. When all have faithfully entered and kept the terms of this commitment, they will become the power and instruments to replenish and reorganize society. So suggests Brother Russell in Volume 1, page 318. 1 Peter 3, verse 21, likens the ark to the deliverance of baptism. This is not the literal baptism of water that marks the beginning of our journey, but the completion of our baptism, as Jesus said in Luke 12, verse 50. I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how am I straitened till it be accomplished? Until it, the baptism, be accomplished. In 1 Peter 3, verse 20, God is described as being long-suffering or patient while the ark was preparing. This was not patience with the wicked generation. Their judgment was already sealed in the sentence of Genesis 6, verse 3 through 7, that we've already considered. God's patience was with the completing of the ark. He will not remove the old order before his people have secured the means of their deliverance. And it is so with us. A similar picture is given in Revelation 7, 2-3. How long the ark was in preparation, we are not told exactly, nor when Noah received his commission, nor when the 120 years began. It is possible that Noah began the work with a few of the faithful generation that preceded him, but that were still living, who, however, died before the flood. The work may have continued with Noah's sons and daughters-in-law when they matured enough to work. Today, is it so different? God is not being patient with this evil generation, which is destined to pass away. He is patient with us in our preparation work. The old order will not pass away until the agents of this new world order are prepared. The year of transition, while secured in the ark, has so little recorded details. Yet so much is implied. All witnessing had ceased. It was a dark night when no man could work. No outside screams of panic are recorded. The feeding and cleaning duties are not detailed. The daily devotions are not mentioned. The source of eternal light is not described, nor how they were able to count the days and months. We are developing a faith that will be in repose when no earthly cords bind us to earth, that will not anguish over the departing institutions, that fully rests in God to meet our every need. It will be remembered in Genesis 7 that God closed the door behind the Noah class. When Noah emerged beyond the storm, his first act is to offer a burnt offering, Genesis 8:20. He took from the clean beasts and offered a multitude of burnt offerings. This in itself was an act of faith. First, he was anticipating the principles laid down specifically in the Mosaic law for clean and unclean. How did he know what was clean and unclean? He was in tune with divine principles. Secondly, he was sacrificing from the very animals that became the seed stock for herds and food for the new generation. He offered from these things that God had preserved and offered them to the Almighty Himself. Tradition says, as we referred to, that Noah used the door from the ark as firewood for this altar. This too as an act of faith, that the arrangement of the ark would never again be needed. When our sacrifice is complete, there will be no more need of this ark, this sacrificial covenant. A burnt offering is generally understood as the acceptance of a prior sacrifice. When the deliverance of the church is complete, when God accepts the lives of the spiritual seed as a sweet fragrance, it will be complete. He will confirm the accepted work of the Christ body. It will give the signal in the sweet smoke that ascends for the earthly portion of the Abrahamic seed to go forth and begin a new and restored human family. After the acceptance of Noah's burnt offering, Genesis 9 details the rainbow covenant between God and all flesh. Verses 12 and 16 describes it as a perpetual and everlasting covenant. In Jeremiah 31, the new covenant is set in contrast to the purging processes of these days. Consider Jeremiah 31:28. As I have washed over them to pluck up and to break down and to throw down and to destroy and to afflict, so will I watch over them to build and to plant, saith the Lord. Is it not so when the church's sacrifice is complete and they are delivered? Then God will make a new covenant with the earthly seed. It will be a confirmation of the rainbow new covenant. While in these days of impending gloom, man fears the destruction of all flesh, Jesus assures us in Matthew 24 that the days of threatening all flesh will be shortened by or through the elect. Not only will the threat be stayed, but all flesh will be saved in respect to the rainbow covenant. This will be under the new heavens of Revelation 21, 1-5. The point that Jesus makes in Matthew 24 about the days of Noah are not that he comes at the point of extremity to rescue mankind, but that as in the days preceding the flood, as in the days of Noah, he would already be present and unknown to society, arranging for human deliverance. These are not signs of his coming or near approach, but of his presence. Parousia is used 4 times in Matthew 24. I want to conclude with a little allegory of 4 birds. Consider these dispensations, A, E, F, and G, as the 4 birds. The raven as an unclean black bird that feeds on dead flesh may picture the first dispensation. Under the dominion of fallen angels, they sought their home among the carcasses of a dying generation. There was nothing for them to return to the ark. Nothing for them in God's covenant arrangements. The dove pictures God's Holy Spirit with different administrations in 3 dispensations. First, God's Spirit worked through the law and the prophets. In the Jewish age. But though Israel returned to the bonds of their covenant, it was empty-handed. Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for. This was the first dove. The second dove was sent out in the gospel age with the mission to prepare a people for his name. This age will bring into the covenant the seal of peace and hope with the completed church. They come home with the olive leaf. The third dove of God's Spirit will be sent out upon the new earth in God's kingdom, the Messianic age, and there finds its eternal home in a restored mankind. So what shall we say for our day of clouds? Let us consider in conclusion 2 Peter 3, verse 10. The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, the thief in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought ye to be in all holy conversation and godliness? Looking for and hastening the presence of the day of God, wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for a new heavens and a new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness. Wherefore, beloved, seeing ye look for such things, be diligent that ye may be found of him in peace, without spot and blameless. And finally, in 1 Thessalonians 3, verse 12, the Lord make you to increase and abound in love one toward another and toward all, even as we toward you. To the end ye may establish your hearts unblameable in holiness before God, even our Father, at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ with all saints. Brethren, it is up to you to bring home the olive leaf. Let us, in God's Spirit, bring home the olive leaf to this weary generation of mankind. May God add his blessing.
I'd like to thank Brother Jerry for the discourse, but now, brethren, as you know, we have question period for 15 minutes, and Brother Jerry will field questions, and there'll be a roving mic that'll be going around to the brethren for the 15-minute time period. Keep in mind, too, brethren, you have your various chronologies and dates that he's been...
Confirmation and just graphical illustrations of the early chronology and the overlaps of some of the patriarchs' lives. We'd be glad to consider any questions if brethren have them. Sister Jean?
Brother Jerry, in Genesis 6, verse 4, it says that there were giants in the earth in those days and also after that. And I was wondering if what your thoughts were on this text, if it were to imply two periods of materialization.
And the phrase after that opens a lot of questions. And generally, I take this to be still prior. These particular giants, these Nephilim, were in these days before Noah. Not necessarily implying after the flood. There were giants or large persons, but I do not think that they were remnants of the Nephilim after the flood. So in these days, at the 120 years boundary, at the time the decree was given, and after that, up till the flood, is how I would take the phrase. It was actually a fear, an unfounded fear, that some of the giants, like Goliath, it was a fear that he was one of the Nephilim. This was a lack of confidence that God had really destroyed all of them, where he was apparently a genetic exception, but not Nephilim, is my thought. Does anyone else have a thought on that? I think the Nephilim did not survive the flood as flesh. Brother N?
The word giants in the scriptures often refers to just large individuals, not necessarily a carryover from the days of Noah. I don't believe any were ever carried over.
I would agree. Thank you. Anyone else? Any other questions or thoughts?
Appreciated the thought, Brother Jerry, on the ark representing Christ and our baptism into Christ. I'm just wondering if there's any association between all the contents, the animals, it mentions the clean and the unclean going into the ark. Is there any link between that picture of what you read in 1 Peter 3?
Any link between the unclean animals and
everything that went into the ark, how we would picture that into the baptism and the picture, the type of Christ and being prepared.
It's an interesting thing. If we look at that picture as the picture of our covenant of sacrifice, our covenant and its deliverance and the transition of the ages, animals, the things of the earth, were also embodied encompassed in this arrangement. And when leaving the ark, God says, made a covenant with every creature of the earth, the covenant with the animals also. So the link that I see is that the world's new covenant is dependent upon our covenant. When our covenant is complete, then the new covenant can begin, but not until. And the new covenant will involve not only human beings, but creatures will become balanced. And so the new covenant will encompass the earth also. This is the only thought I have. There may be some extended thoughts there that could be drawn that I have not seen. Anyone else a thought on the creatures that were taken on the ark? Incidentally, a question that often comes up in this connection, I know it wasn't your question exactly, but we're all creatures, you know, every species of the earth on board. And that then extends to the question of how global was the flood. And these are also questions that expand our thinking. But generally, I think they represent the ingredients of the new covenant that follow the sacrificial covenant.
We have another question. I'm not a horticulturist, but we understand that a tree cannot be completely buried in water for a year and still have leaves. The question is, where did the olive tree have its green olives or green branches and leaves after being buried underwater for 1 year?
I don't have an answer for that either. I do know that, and I don't know that that is a limitation, and it may be. It may have been the height at which some of these trees may have not been buried for all of that period of time. The water was, you didn't have global water depth for 12 months. You had rains, you had water rising, you had water descending. So it may not have been total submersion for that length of time. But I would have a curious question also. Where did the olive leaf come from? Anyone else have a thought? Brother N?
I believe the thought is that the water covered where Noah and the family of Noah's family and the children of Adam at that time. That area was completely submerged in water. But you raise a question about all the species. Just think of the number of monkeys in the world, all the species of monkeys. We know they weren't all on the ark. Therefore, we recognize what was, I think your opening statement was, what was territorial animals, that which they were used to, they were in the ark. So for that reason, too, there were trees outside of the flood area that could have had the leaves and the dove brought that back.
And also I would take that the animals were basically root species, that there was diversion of species a great deal also after the exodus of the ark. And human civilization was this oftentimes called the cradle of civilization through Turkey, Iran, Iraq, in this area along the Euphrates after leaving Eden. So apparently the rest of the globe was not populated with humans.
I'm not also, as Brother Ed said, a horticulturist. I'm sure Brother John Edgar could have helped us a little on that.
Yes.
But I wondered, you didn't bring anything in this way about the grapevine in relation to... That would be interesting. We know, of course, in John's Gospel, we have the grapevine picture.
Yeah, yeah.
And we know, as you brought out, that it was in the day that we are living. The world is encompassed with certainly all of this immoralities and all of the drunkenness that you brought out of the eating and drinking and so forth. Where the church is in a different picture.
Right,
and
right.
I thought perhaps you might have brought out something along that line with a grapevine.
It's an interesting consideration. There's lots of room for expanding and using our imagination on some of these things, and some of them are productive, and some of them we just... But it's interesting that Noah became drunken after the flood. And apparently, Noah is not upbraided at fault for this problem as much as his sons were. The sons were on trial. So this process of fermentation of the grape appears to have occurred after the flood.
Well, system, we have so many children today, it's very difficult to instruct children today. And we're ourselves instructed to train up our children in the way that they should conduct themselves. We see also after the flood when the Shem, Japheth, Ham partook, this is true that the children are very disobedient to parents as well as to teachers. Right. We are in this stage right now. Appreciated your thoughts, Brother Leslie. Right.
Thank you. So we'll have a couple minutes for questions. Anyone have a thought?
I just wanted to ask a question, first of all, in relation to the altar. You said that Noah used the door of the altar, or tradition has it that he used the door of the altar to fire the altar as the wood. And you said that was the first. I didn't get that. Because Cain also made an altar to the Lord, did he not? In which he offered his first fruit.
Who offered?
Cain?
Yes. But I don't think the same phrase is used. It might be. But I did not think that the phrase burnt offering was used. But it is true that there were offerings and an altar used. If the phrase burnt offering is used earlier, I appreciate that being brought to my attention. But it is true that Abel had an offering. Perhaps it is. You know, it was an oversight, if that's true. But the idea of the door is only tradition. And this was, you know, a layer of a possibility that we suggested that whatever Noah did was an act of faith. He was in this. If the ark represents the covenant of sacrifice, when it is finished, it is closed. It will not be reused. This boat, if ever to be found, may not have a door. But the thought was that the boat is not to be reused again, as much as the rainbow covenant promised it would not. So when our sacrifice is finished, this is not going to be another program like this in the future. It's an allegorical extension. Any thought on the? I just am not looking at it at the moment. Is how about the Abel sacrifice? Is it? Yeah. Sister Connie.
When you said that about the door, my first thought was, being that he was sacrificing an animal, pure one or whatever.
Yeah.
And he used the door of the ark would show that through faith he didn't, you know, like you say, he didn't ever expect to need the ark again for a flood. And another thing, when an animal sacrificed, it pictured Jesus. Yeah. And Jesus, when he sacrificed, you could say he opened the door. And by burning the door of the ark, it showed that whatever room it was, there was no clothes there. To me, without no clothes there, it was open.
Right. Yeah.
He opened the door because he said, "I am the life, the door, you know, or the door and the way, or something like that." And he opened the way. And to me, that burning of the door showed that he opened the way. There was no clothes anymore.
However, we wouldn't build too much on this. You know, it's not of us, saith the Lord. So it's sort of a nice accommodation of mind, but we wouldn't stake a whole lot on that point. But generally, dry wood is needed. They were on a mountainside. Waters were prevalent, and it may have been. One more quick question, Sister Farrell.
From the comment that was made, and you didn't refute it, I was curious, do you believe then that it was not a global flood, it was only in that local area?
I think the flood effects were universal, but we project our thinking. I don't conceive it as globally covered with water to, you know, 1,000 feet deep. I think that the effects are seen in this continent with the glacier effect, the collapse of the rings, the rushing from the poles to the equator. So I think that the effects were perhaps global, but not water so deep around the earth. But then mountains were pushed up and valleys pushed down. So the effect was to destroy human civilization in that vicinity where the waters were tidal in their effect. That's my thought, but credibility to the other view as well. Thank you, brother.
Thank you, brother, very much, Brother Jerry, and for the effort that went into preparing that discourse and the research. And their scriptures are difficult in many regards, and we're very blessed with the significance of many things regarding Noah and his day and the application to ourselves, brethren, in the scriptural account for how we're to learn the lessons from Noah. And we're very appreciative, Brother Jerry, of all that effort you put into that. Thank you very much. Brethren, before we close with the closing hymn, I just want to mention a couple of things before I forget. I've been forgetting a few things today, so forgive me. I'd like to mention that after the break, the young people's class is at 11 o'clock, 4 to 8-year-olds. With Sister Lucy Cooley, and the 9 to 12-year-old group with Sister Debbie Hrachik. And there'll be other children's classes in the afternoon, which will be announced then, so that they have the announcement right up to date when it's going to take place. But just in advance, the afternoon will be 1:45 and 4:45. And also, there are order forms for tapes on the book table over here, brethren. And if anybody else has anything that must be stated now, is there anything I'm missing? Anybody?
CO sign-up list.
The CO sign-up list on the side as well, brethren, for those that haven't signed up for their testimony to their presence here and the record of that fact. So please sign up. And ask Brother Jerry to close with prayer.
Gracious Father in heaven, hallowed be thy name. We thank thee for the faithfulness of these men of old. We thank thee for the lessons and the focus upon our times and seasons and the prospect that lies just before us. Help us to be faithful to our privileges, to finish this covenant, this baptism, to bring thee glory and honor, to be instruments of thy peace and blessing to thy new world. This end, we leave our lives in loving care and ask thy blessing and our continued fellowship. In Jesus' dear name, amen.
And brethren, we will reconvene for the next discourse. Please be here at 5 to 11, brethren, so that we can be ready at 11 o'clock. And I believe there's coffee and treats and things in the back for the break.